Imagine knowing the exact decade that your family's main source of income is just going to completely dry up.
Right. It's a terrifying thought.
Yeah, exactly. The asset that literally built your entire way of life, it just has a hard expiration date. And today we're looking at a country taking what is probably the world's most aggressive multi-trillion-dollar gamble to completely rewrite its economic DNA before that clock runs out.
A massive gamble, yeah.
So welcome to the deep dive. We have this huge stack of notes and insights in front of us from the Gamma blog, and our mission today is decoding Saudi Arabia's Vision 2030.
Which is, I mean, it's a fascinating topic.
It really is. And specifically, we're looking at this whole transformation through the lens of foreign direct investment, or FDI, mm-hmm. because you cannot just re-engineer a national economy in a vacuum. You need the world's money, and honestly, you need the world's expertise.
Well, looking at the materials from the Gamma blog, the stakes are made incredibly clear right from the start.
Yeah.
Diversifying away from oil is... it's no longer just some aspirational whiteboard goal for the kingdom. I mean, it is a strict, undeniable necessity for their long-term economic sustainability.
Because the oil has a ticking clock.
Exactly. The oil economy has a ticking clock, and Saudi Arabia is recognizing that building this post-oil investment industry is the fundamental requirement to maintain their status as a global economic powerhouse.
Right.
They essentially have to transition from exporting a commodity to importing capital and innovation.
Okay, let's unpack this for you listening, because shifting a nation's reliance away from petroleum requires fundamentally changing how hard it is for outsiders to do business. It's like, imagine knowing your main source of income is eventually going to run out, right?
Right.
So you decide to completely remodel your massive house, and at the exact same time, you decide to host the biggest networking party in the world inside that house.
That's actually a really good way to visualize it.
Right. So today we're promising you a clear-eyed look at how Saudi Arabia is rewriting its rule book to lure in that global talent and cash,
mm-hmm.
where the biggest opportunities lie, and the very real cultural and bureaucratic hurdles that investors are going to face.
Because historically, doing business there as a foreign entity was, frankly, highly complex.
Heavily fortified.
But under the Vision 2030 umbrella, the kingdom is attempting to dismantle those legacy barriers. And the primary mechanism driving this shift, the thing really turning heads globally, is the newly implemented Saudi investment law.
Yeah, the Gamma blog notes are huge on this.
Mm-hmm.
According to our sources, the headline feature of this new law is that foreign investors can now hold 100% ownership of their businesses in several key sectors.
Which is unprecedented there.
Right. They are entirely removing the historical requirement to have a local Saudi partner.
Mm.
And, I mean, on paper, that is a massive lure. But I get stuck on the reality of operating without that local partner.
How so?
Well, if I'm a mid-sized tech company based in London, taking full equity sounds great, but removing a local partner also means removing my local shield.
I see what you mean.
Yeah, I no longer have a fixer to navigate the local ministries. I'm suddenly flying blind in a completely different regulatory environment.
Yeah.
Doesn't that sort of negate the perk of full ownership?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that ownership is definitely the bait. But the unified platform they're building is intended to replace the need for that local shield.
Okay, how does that work?
To address the exact anxiety you're describing, the Ministry of Investment has created this single source digital platform.
Oh, right.
The goal is to bypass the old fragmented system where, you know, a foreign company had to knock on the doors of five different ministries just to get a permit or secure visas or clear customs.
So they are trying to digitize the fixer.
They are trying to institutionalize transparency.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. When you force the regulatory process through a single visible portal, you reduce the reliance on who you know. It shifts the dynamic to a standardized legal process. You don't need a local partner to grease the wheels if the track is clearly laid out in front of you.
Right, right.
And alongside this, they are establishing these special economic zones, or SEZs. These zones act as regulatory sandboxes offering tax holidays and critically relaxed customs duties.
Explain how those SEZs interact with the broader economy. Because if you're a foreign company importing highly specialized tech hardware, I mean, standard customs could bleed your margins dry before you even plug a server in.
That is the exact friction the SEZs are designed to eliminate.
Okay.
By setting up within an SEC, a foreign firm operates under a parallel, much more relaxed set of commercial rules compared to the rest of the country.
Got it.
It radically lowers the barrier to entry for importing capital goods, which makes the prospect of retaining that 100% ownership highly attractive. They are shifting from a highly protected market to one actively competing for your capital.
But if you are giving up all that equity to foreigners, you have to ensure the money actually flows into the right sectors, right, to benefit the national economy.
Absolutely.
And this is where their GDP targets come into play. And the scale outlined in the Gamma blog is just, it's difficult to overstate. They're aiming to increase the private sector share of the GDP from 40% to 65%.
That's a massive jump.
Huge.
Yeah.
They also want to boost private healthcare investment from 25 to 35%, which is driven by the demands of an aging population.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you have tech, logistics, and tourism.
Yeah, the logistics play is fascinating because it leverages pure geography.
Right.
Saudi Arabia sits directly at the crossroads of Asia, Africa, and Europe. So they are heavily funding government-led initiatives and infrastructure upgrades to really position themselves as the premier global supply chain hub.
Which makes perfect sense geographically.
And regarding tourism, they have set a target of 100 million annual visitors.
100 million.
Exactly, leaning heavily into ecotourism, heritage sites, and luxury hospitality.
And to physically house all of this ambition, they're constructing what they call giga projects.
Right. The Giga Project.
We were talking about the Red Sea Project for ecotourism, King Abdullah Economic City, or KAEE, for massive industrial logistics, and NEO.
NEOM is the big one.
Yeah, NEOM, the futuristic smart cities that are supposed to completely reshape urban living with integrated AI and renewable energy. But, and here's where it gets really interesting. And let's look at this from the perspective of an international investor. Say you're sitting in a boardroom in Tokyo or New York.
Okay.
Building futuristic smart cities from scratch in the middle of the desert sounds inherently perilous. I mean, why on earth would I bet my firm's capital on an unbuilt, multi-billion dollar sci-fi city?
Because you aren't taking the baseline risk alone.
Oh.
This brings us to probably the most vital mechanism in the Vision 2030 strategy, which is the Public Investment Fund, or the PIF.
Right, the PIF.
The PIF is the Sovereign Wealth Fund of Saudi Arabia, and they utilize a highly specific shared risk model. So for you listening, think of the PIF not just as a government backer, but as an anchor tenant in a new mega mall.
Okay, an anchor tenant absorbs the initial infrastructure risk to draw in the smaller retailers.
Precisely. That's how the PIF operates on a balance sheet. When you have a sovereign wealth fund stepping in to co-invest, they take on the heavy lifting of the capital expenditure.
Meaning what, exactly?
Meaning they provide the land, they fund the baseline infrastructure, and they take an equity stake in the joint venture. So for a foreign board of directors, this completely alters the internal rate of return calculations.
Okay.
You aren't building an electric vehicle factory or an AI data center in the desert entirely on your own dime. You are building it with one of the most well-capitalized financial institutions on the planet absorbing the initial systemic risk.
Wow.
It dramatically lowers the temperature for foreign capital.
That significantly changes the math. If the landlord is paying for half the foundation and guaranteeing the zoning permits, a foreign corporation is much more likely to show up and build the actual storefront.
Exactly.
But despite the PIF acting as this massive anchor tenant and the tax holidays within the SEZs, the Gamma blog sources are explicit about this next part. Transplanting a foreign business into the kingdom is not a seamless plug-and-play operation.
No, not at all. Entering a market as unique as Saudi Arabia requires deep operational adjustments. The environment is aggressively modernizing, sure, but the structural and cultural friction is very real.
Right, so let's examine that friction.
Right.
First up, bureaucratic hurdles. Even with the single source digital platform we discussed, our sources warn that there is still inconsistent regulatory implementation across different regions.
Right.
A permit might be processed seamlessly in Riyadh, but then it stalls completely in a different province.
Which is why the sources explicitly state that working with experienced local legal advisors remains absolutely essential.
So you still need a bit of a fixer.
In a way, yes. The central digital platform handles the macro approvals, but navigating regional municipal codes still requires localized expertise. You simply cannot operate on autopilot there.
This sounds like trying to play a board game where the rules change depending on which room of the house you're sitting in.
That's a fair analogy, actually.
And then you hit the most profound structural difference, which is Sharia law. The legal and financial system is rooted in Islamic jurisprudence.
Yes.
And for a Western institutional investor, this requires a total paradigm shift. particularly because Islamic finance strictly prohibits interest-based lending.
That's the big hurdle for a lot of Western firms.
Right. So how does a foreign financial firm even begin to operate if traditional interest-based lending is completely off the table? How do you structure a corporate loan or mortgage in that environment?
This raises an important question, and the answer is that instead of traditional interest, Islamic finance relies heavily on profit and loss sharing agreements, or asset-backed leasing arrangements.
Okay, can you give me an example of that?
Sure. Let's say a Western firm needs to finance a new logistics center. Instead of borrowing $100 million at a 6% interest rate, they might engage in a leasing structure where the bank actually purchases the logistics center.
The bank buys the building.
Yes, the bank buys it and then leases it back to the firm at a markup, which is paid in installments. Or, alternatively, they structure a joint venture where the financier shares directly in the actual operational profits of that center.
Oh, so the yield is tied to the actual performance of a tangible asset, rather than just the passage of time on a loan.
That is the core distinction, exactly. It requires foreign asset managers to completely pivot their standard investment vehicles.
Right.
You have to translate traditional bonds into sukuk, which are Islamic financial certificates that represent a portion of ownership in a portfolio of eligible existing or future assets.
Wow.
And alongside this massive financial restructuring, foreign firms also have to adapt to cultural norms that heavily dictate workplace dynamics, decision-making hierarchies, and really just how long-term business relationships are fostered.
And nothing impacts those workplace dynamics more than the Saudization policies.
Yes.
This is the strict government mandate requiring foreign companies to hire a specific percentage of Saudi nationals. Now, I look at this and I see a massive operational bottleneck.
A lot of people do.
Because if you are a specialized cybersecurity firm or like a cutting-edge green energy startup, local talent with those specific technical skills might be incredibly scarce.
Yeah.
So you are suddenly forced to meet a quota that compromises your operational efficiency.
It's easy to view the Saudization quotas as just an arbitrary bureaucratic tax on foreign companies.
Yeah.
But if we analyze the strategic intent behind Vision 2030, this friction is entirely by design. Saudi Arabia doesn't just want foreign money. I mean, if they simply wanted to grow a financial portfolio, they would just invest their oil revenue into Western markets.
Right, they just buy stocks.
Exactly. What they are aggressively pursuing here is knowledge transfer.
They're using access to their market as leverage to force foreign companies to build human capital locally.
Exactly. Saudization compels foreign companies to establish rigorous training programs, technical institutes, and mentorship pipelines.
Okay.
Yes, finding highly specialized local talent is a short-term hurdle. But the mandate forces companies to take a Saudi graduate and actively train them into a senior engineer over the next decade. The kingdom wants to permanently elevate its middle class and its internal technical base. They refuse to simply rent foreign expertise that, you know, packs up and leaves when a project is completed. They are demanding that global skills and operational best practices are permanently transferred to their citizens.
It's the ultimate tool for market access.
It really is.
You can keep 100% of the equity, and the PIF will literally co-invest to lower your risk. But the price of admission is that you must educate the next generation of the Saudi workforce.
Which is a brilliant long-term strategy for them.
It's a fascinating play. Now, to see if this complex exchange of capital, risk, and education is actually viable, we need to look at the first movers. Like, who is actually navigating this environment successfully?
Well, the case studies provided in our sources demonstrate that these ambitious targets are translating into very tangible, highly profitable realities for companies that really understand the assignment.
The most prominent example from the Gamma blog is Lucid Motors.
Yes, a perfect example.
They are a U.S.-based electric vehicle manufacturer, and they committed to a massive $3 billion investment to build their first overseas manufacturing facility directly in KAE King Abdullah Economic City.
And what's fascinating here is the strategic alignment. The Public Investment Fund owns a significant stake in Lucid Motors.
Oh, right.
They didn't just inject capital into Lucid to watch them build cars in Arizona. They utilized that leverage to pull the physical manufacturing supply chain into Saudi Arabia.
What?
It perfectly positions the kingdom to become a native player in high technology manufacturing and sustainability, which maps directly onto the Vision 2030 objectives.
And you also see massive moves from traditional financial titans, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like BlackRock and HSBC are setting up major asset management operations in Riyadh.
Yes.
And they're there to intensify the kingdom's capital markets. When a giant like BlackRock commits resources to build out local financial planning, it acts as a massive signal to the rest of the global market that the infrastructure to handle trillions in FDI is actively being constructed.
Definitely. And returning to that goal of 100 million tourists, you see heavy involvement from global hospitality brands.
Right.
Accor and Marriott are actively partnering with local developers to expand luxury resorts and heritage-driven experiences. They are laying the literal groundwork to house that influx of visitors.
Our sources also highlight emerging opportunities in the broader digital economy. So AI, cybersecurity, fintech, and particularly green energy, where Saudi Arabia is leading Middle Eastern initiatives in large-scale solar and wind.
It's a very broad push.
It is, but looking at this list, Lucid, BlackRock, HSBC, Marriott,
yep.
These are massive, massive global titans.
Yes.
It makes me wonder, are they receiving a totally different VIP experience that simply isn't available to a mid-sized green energy startup trying to navigate the exact same Saudization quotas and regional bureaucracy?
Well, scale certainly brings leverage in any global market, obviously.
Sure.
But the critical takeaway from these first movers is the pattern of their selection.
Brand name.
Look at how they align. BlackRock maps onto the need for financial maturity. Marriott maps onto economic diversification through tourism. Lucid maps onto advanced manufacturing and sustainability.
Okay, I see.
These first movers prove that the ease of doing business in Saudi Arabia is directly correlated to how closely a company's core operations help the kingdom achieve its specific Vision 2030 targets. The VIP treatment is heavily dependent on your strategic alignment with the state's goals.
So if you are building the exact piece of the puzzle they need, the door's open.
Precisely.
But if you're just looking for, like, a tax haven without transferring any knowledge, you're going to hit a wall.
You'll hit a wall very quickly.
Okay, so summarizing everything we've pulled from the Gamma blog today, evaluating foreign direct investment in Saudi Arabia heading into 2025 reveals what might be one of the most compelling portfolio opportunities available.
Absolutely.
The structural reforms, the 100% ownership laws, the single source platforms, and just the sheer volume of capital being deployed by the PIF. It creates a massive runway for global expansion.
But, and this is a big but,
yeah.
It is only a smart move if a company enters with a highly structured plan.
Right.
You must respect the realities of Sharia-compliant finance. You have to adapt to regional bureaucratic variances. And you have to fully embrace the mandate to actively train and integrate the local workforce.
And for you listening, even if you aren't a billionaire investor, watching Saudi Arabia's current trajectory is just crucial.
It is a real-time macroeconomic masterclass. We are witnessing an experiment on a scale that is rarely attempted in human history. They are utilizing their immense consolidated wealth, their strategic geographic location, and highly targeted international partnerships to aggressively pivot a single commodity economy into a diversified technological global hub.
Because they know the oil revenue won't last forever.
Exactly.
And they are ensuring that when the transition is finally complete, they possess a state-of-the-art infrastructure run entirely by a highly skilled domestic workforce.
That's the ultimate goal.
Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. But before we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final thought to ponder based on everything we've analyzed today.
Well, let's hear it.
We've seen how Saudi Arabia is successfully utilizing its sovereign wealth to mandate the transfer of global skills, right? They are pulling top-tier companies to their doorstep and using the PIF to absorb the initial risk. But think about the broader implications of that. What happens to the global dynamics of innovation when a single nation possesses the consolidated capital to simply buy up the world's top talent and strictly mandate them to build the future in the desert?
That's a heavy question.
Doesn't the sheer gravitational pull of that capital eventually shift the center of gravity for global tech, finance, and sustainability away from traditional hubs forever? Something to think about. Until next time.